Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, West End. How are you doing? Brill. Possibly the best so far today. We are on... No competitive spirit down here on the front row at all, is there? We're on week 8 of a series of talks entitled The Heart of the Matter, which is basically all about how we can live an emotionally healthy life. And we've been looking at how our inner life, thoughts, feelings, emotions, shapes the way we live and how we need to process those emotions in a healthy way. When it comes to things like handling grief and loss, dealing with issues around our identity, processing negative emotions like anger. And today it's the third of 4 talks in the middle of this series around the whole area of sex, dating, singleness, and relationships. I hope you are loving it so far. And the title of today's talk is Resisting the Forbidden Fruit. And in particular, I want to look at the whole area of handling temptation and handling sexual temptation in particular. Now, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, you'll remember we looked at the whole area of sex and relationships through the lens of Andy Crouch's brilliant book, Strong and Weak. And the next slide coming up is where we finished that talk. And I slow it, it might well jog a few memories, but if you weren't here, you are in overwhelm right now. And we covered a lot of ground, and I show it by way of signaling that you need to go and have a listen to that talk. Because there will be things that I don't say about sex and relationships because I shared them a couple of weeks ago. These two talks very much go hand in hand. Suffice to say this, if 2 weeks ago we looked at how we can really flourish in this area, today is looking at how this particular area of life can go very, very badly wrong. If 2 weeks ago was all about how, in theory, we need to move up and to the right, today is all about how do we avoid moving down and to the left? How can we avoid all the temptations, mistakes, and pitfalls that can rob us of the depth of connection, the intimacy, the flourishing that is possible in this area? And it's going to be a very different talk from the one that I gave a couple of weeks ago. I'm afraid there won't be many funny illustrations or stories at all, I'm afraid. You bunch of consumers, you. Sometimes you just have to learn the Bible. But what I want to do is, rather than looking at this subject in all of its breadth, instead I want to walk through a particular case study of somebody in the Bible who got things very, very badly wrong in this area, and to see what we can learn from their mistakes. Their name was Samson. And you can read about their story in the Old Testament book of Judges. Bit of background, it kicks off in Judges 13. God comes to a guy called Zorah and says, you are going to have a son and he is going to be extra special. And as a result, you are to devote him to God as what's called a Nazarite. Now, this is a curious idea to us today, but if you go back to the Old Testament, Numbers chapter 6, you can see that on occasion, people might devote themselves to God as what's called a Nazarite. And there were 3 particular parts to this vow. Firstly, you wouldn't drink any wine at all. Secondly, you wouldn't use any kind of razor on your head. And thirdly, you wouldn't go near a dead body. Now, for most people, this would be devotion for a particular season. For Samson, this is more of a way of life. And so he grows up with these regular reminders that he is utterly devoted to God. And he is a guy with extraordinary gifts. He lives in a culture where physical strength really matters. And he has got shed loads of it. He can beat an enemy army on his own just with his bare hands. He can rip apart a wild animal, such is his strength. He was so dazzling, so impressive, that men wanted to be like him and women wanted to be with him. When people came to him and said, Samson, hey, you're the man. He wouldn't be terribly British and say, no, you're the man. He'd be like, yes, I am the man. That was Samson. And to add to all of that, he was not only judge and ruler of the people of Israel, but he also had what the Bible might call spiritual anointing. He had great power from God, but he also had a serious weakness. You see, inwardly, his character was seriously misshapen. He was deeply broken inside. In fact, not only is the story of Samson a tragic tale of what can happen when you give in to temptation, it's also an interesting case study of what can happen when your gifting exceeds your character. When your talents and abilities are way greater than your character can contain. Samson was dazzlingly impressive on the outside, but seriously broken on the inside. As a small aside on this, one of the questions I'm sometimes asked from people who are exploring the whole Christianity deal, and incidentally, if that is you, you are so welcome, is when you look through the Old Testament in particular and the people God uses, doesn't it seem to indicate that God endorses things like polygamy or lying, cheating, swindling, or murder? Because God seems to bless and use people who live like that. And what does that say about the character of God? Well, one of the things I love about the Bible is it never paints human beings as simplistic. It never says, here's the bad people over here, and here's the good people over there, and we all need to be like the good people over there. Now, the Bible paints humanity as it is, warts and all, with all our weaknesses and failings. And sometimes, while it doesn't say so explicitly, the power of the story shows up the folly of certain decisions. So, for example, whenever you read of polygamy in the Old Testament, taking many wives or many sexual partners, as Samson will do, it always, always, always ends up going badly. God does not endorse polygamy. It may not say so explicitly in the Bible, but sometimes the power of the narrative, the power of the story, can show up how destructive certain lifestyle choices can be. So it is with Samson. So his story as an adult kicks off in Judges chapter 14. This is the first thing we read about him as an adult. It says this: Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his mum and dad, "I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." Notice, how well does Samson know this woman? Not very well. Just says he saw her. Not he was in a reading group with her and was captivated by her intelligence. Not he noticed her compassion for the needy and was moved by her humility. No, he saw her. And to see is going to be one of the key words used to describe Samson's life. In fact, the writer will often use a repeated phrase, words to the effect of, he saw, he wanted, he went down. He saw, he wanted, he went down, and then there's trouble. That's where Samson's slippery slope to temptation starts, with what he sees and what he wants. I won't repeat much of what's been said over the last 2 weeks about the image-obsessed culture in which we live, where it's all about what you see. Just one stat Liam said last week really resonated: 1.4 billion swipes on Tinder every single day. That is 16,000 swipes a second. I see, I want, I see, I don't want. I see, I want, I see, I don't want. What does that do to us in terms of the pressure to look a certain way ourselves, and perhaps even more significantly, the way that we see other people and maybe even judge them just on appearance? Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of a guy called Woody Allen, well known in the film industry. A number of years ago, he created a bit of a scandal when he left his wife at the time and he married the girl who had been his adoptive daughter. And a big press conference was held, lots of journalists came. One of them asked him this question: how on earth could you do such a thing? Woody Allen's response was this: the heart wants what it wants. The heart wants what it wants. That's the human condition. That is all of our problem. We see, we want. That was Samson. He sees, he wants, he ends up going down. John Ortberg, I'm a huge fan of his, brilliant leader and author in the States. Credit to him for much of the material in this talk. Certainly the best bits, I'm sure, are his rather than mine. He puts it like this: desire overcomes the will by obsessing the mind. What does that mean? Well, I have never met anyone who wills, who intends to give in to temptation, who embarks on a new relationship or a marriage or life more broadly, intending to mess up or to give in. But desire overcomes the will by obsessing the mind. We think about it, we fantasize, we think some more, and eventually we end up seeing and wanting and going down. This is wonderfully illustrated by a guy called Mike Pilavarci, great friend of us at Christchurch, part of our Council of Reference alongside Andy Crouch and several others. And he tells a very honest story that illustrates this about where he messed up. Some of you may have heard it before. Let me share it with you. He says this: this is a story about where I messed up. It was one evening, I was speaking and knew I was having friends over the next night, so in the freezer was a double chocolate cake. So I took it out, put it in the fridge to defrost. I went to the meeting and arrived home late. When you do ministry, you often come home vulnerable when you're tired, especially if you're alone. I came home, thought, I'm going straight to bed, I'll just get a glass of water. I went to the kitchen, poured myself some water, and I remembered the double chocolate cake in the fridge. I was just curious and wondered, has it defrosted? I thought I'd check. I opened the fridge door, and you will not believe what happened next. As I opened the door, the double chocolate cake spoke to me. "Hello, Mike," it said. "Hello, double chocolate cake," I replied. Then the cake said, "How are you?" "Oh, I'm okay. I've just come back from a meeting, and I'm very tired. I'm just about to go to bed." And to be polite, I added, "How are you?" The cake replied, "Well, I'm okay. Just very bored in this fridge. I only have an old cucumber and two tomatoes for company." "I know. You're tired, I'm bored. Why don't you put me on the table, sit down, and we can have a little chat?" I thought, that sounds fair enough. "Can't do any harm to have a little chat while I drink my water. Then I'll put you back and I'll go to bed, but I'm not going to eat you." Then the cake said, "Of course not. You've had your evening meal and I'm for tomorrow. We've got that out the way." So I put the cake on the table and we had the sort of conversation you have with a double chocolate cake. Then after a while, I said to the cake, "Listen, cakey," because by now we were getting intimate. "I was just wondering, are you defrosted?" Cakey thought for a moment and said, "You know, I'm not quite sure. Why don't you run your finger along my cream and have a little taste?" I thought, just to run my finger through Cakey's cream and have a little taste, I mean, that's not wrong. Technically, it's not going all the way. So I had a little taste of Cakey's cream. "Oh, Cakey, your cream is defrosted." What I'm thinking now is, are you defrosted deep, deep in the heart of you? Cakey thought some more and said, "You know, I don't know. The only way you can find out is if you cut just a little sliver of me. Then you can put the cream over and no one will know tomorrow." And I thought, just a little sliver. And if I don't, I won't know, will I? So I had a little taste. "Oh, Cakey, you are defrosted deep in the heart of you." Well, that night, one thing led to another. And by the end of the evening, that double chocolate cake and I were one flesh. I wish I could stand here and say every mouthful was agony, but it wasn't. It was wonderful. I loved every moment. And you know, as I was eating Cakey, I thought, this seems so right. What's wrong with this? I'm not hurting anyone. Cakey and I, we love each other. Then when I finished, I looked at the empty plate. I looked at the spoon with those tiny chocolate hundreds and thousands. I looked at the knife with bits of cream and sponge attached. And then suddenly the plate and the spoon and the knife, they screamed at me, "Murderer, murderer, murderer." I thought to myself, what have I done? I've killed Cakey. This is horrible. I felt ill. Why did I do that? That's the problem with giving in to temptation. At the time, it's nice, but afterwards, it's payback time. And all that night, I had payback time. Where did I go wrong? I'll tell you where I went wrong. I opened the fridge door. And we all know what I'm talking about, don't we? I'm not just talking about double chocolate cake. I'm talking about strawberry cheesecake, profiteroles and cream, lemon meringue pie. And I'm talking about sex outside of marriage. Do not open the fridge door. Be ruthless. We can all relate to that. Samson, at this point in the story, has well and truly opened the fridge door. The narrative goes on to show he's not even talked with this woman yet, and yet he sees her and he wants her. What does he want? There is stuff going on inside his head that the narrative doesn't even tell us about. Suffice to say this, he is well and truly having a conversation with Cakey. Bible's got some stuff to say about this. Book of James, New Testament says this, "Each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin when full grown gives birth to death." Just a tiny thing like seeing and wanting can lead us on a very tragic journey. So it is with Samson. You know, this whole series of talks is about recognizing there are thoughts and feelings that go on in here, and we have to deal with them appropriately if we are to flourish in life. First thing Samson doesn't deal with in here, it is lust. It is desire. What should he have done to avoid even getting to this point? Very simple. He should have watched what he watched. He should have been ruthless with what he filled his mind with. The Bible has loads to say on this. Old Testament book of Proverbs puts it like this. If there is someone on your way home from work who could lead you into temptation, find a different route home. Steer well clear. More famously, the words of Jesus, Matthew 5, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out, throw it away. Picture language, not to be taken literally. But a sign of the ruthlessness with which we are to live in this area, what might that look like? Just a couple of practical examples from my own life. And you've got to work out what this looks like for you. But firstly, I have just become very careful with what I watch on TV. Now, the average TV viewer in the UK sees 14,000 sexual scenes every year. That is extraordinary. What does that do to our minds? To our hearts, to our expectations, to our desires? You know, there's some good stuff out there. I've decided I'm not going to watch it because it's wrong to watch it. No. But because I know how weak I am, and I know from stories like this that seeing can lead to wanting, can lead to going down. Another example, which will sound a little Victorian and prudish to some. But when Joy and I were dating, we just made a decision that we wouldn't go on holiday together. We just felt that actually we should save that for when we are married, because we think actually if we're going to get that close, we need the power of covenant commitment to say, hey, when I find out things about you that I don't like and you about me, you need to know and I want to know that we are committed to each other nonetheless. And so we decided we'll go on all the holidays we want when we are married. Before then, we won't. For two reasons. Firstly, for the same principle as that Proverbs verse. Why go down a road where we could be led into temptation? Let's just play it safe. But secondly, we also don't just want individual flourishing, we want corporate flourishing. And I would have utterly hated to go away on holiday with Joy, and to be honest, we probably would have been fine. But I would have hated somebody else to watch what we did and think, oh, Andy and Joy did it, therefore it's okay for us. And they end up crashing through boundaries that we never would, because they followed our example. And at some level, at least, we must bear some responsibility. And so not only for our own good, but for our community's good, we thought, let's play it safe. What about you? You think of not only how you can flourish, but how your community can flourish as well. And just to say, if any of you feel a bit condemned or guilty, remember those are not fruits of the Holy Spirit. This isn't a rule. Actually, it's what's in the heart that counts. But at the very least, if you're listening to this feeling, no, I really want to go away on holiday with my boyfriend or girlfriend, can I at least encourage you to listen to the talk I gave 2 weeks ago? My Beyoncé quote got such positive feedback that suffice to say this, if I was a boy, crazy in love, with a grown woman, I would not want to put a ring on it for all the single ladies. Thank you very much. That's five Beyoncé songs in one sentence. Seriously though, don't hurt yourself, Diva. Listen to some daddy lessons for your formation. That's five more. I just, half my prep went into that sentence. Beyoncé owns this sermon. Samson's tragic tale. It all starts with seeing and wanting and going down, and he should have been ruthless with what he put his mind to. Notice, by the way, his aggressive language, mom, dad, get her for me. This was seen as a sign of utter disrespect in that culture. In that culture, it would have been the mum and the dad who decided who their child would marry. Might sound a bit outdated today. Speaking personally now, as the father of three children, I'd like to bring that back. But anyway, just saying. His mum and dad reply by saying this, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? But Samson said to his dad, get her for me. She's the right one for me. Bit of background here. Uncircumcised Philistines. It's a phrase you see from time to time in the Old Testament, and it is uniquely applied to the Philistines. You see, they were a people that were about as far as you could get from Israel's values and culture. They worshipped a god called Baal. And things like cultic prostitution and infant sacrifice were standard parts of their religious practice. They would often kill little children as part of their worship to Baal. And the Hebrews found this so disgusting, so repulsive, that they nicknamed Baal Beelzebul, means Lord of the Flies. That's where that phrase comes from. The dung heap, where there's stench and death. And in the New Testament, that word became synonymous with the evil one, the devil. His parents are basically saying, look, you go down that route, it's gonna end in pain. Samson is blinkered now. No, she's the one for me. Get her for me. The story continues. Judges 14, verse 5. Samson went down to Timnah. Suddenly, a young lion came roaring towards him. The Spirit of the Lord came powerfully on him, so he tore the lion apart with his bare hands as he might have torn a young goat, but he told neither his mum or dad what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and he liked her. Sometime later, when he went back to marry her, he turned aside to look at the lion's carcass, and in it he saw a swarm of bees and some honey. He scooped out the honey with his hands and ate as he went along. When he rejoined his parents, he gave them some, and they too ate, but he didn't tell them he had taken the honey from the lion's carcass. It's a painting coming up by Rubens depicting part of this part of the story. Why on earth is it in the Samson story? I think two reasons. First reason is this. Samson goes near the carcass of a lion. A dead body. Why? Because he's hungry. He sees, he wants, he takes. The heart wants what it wants. He has broken the first part of his vow to God. Second reason is this. At some level, I think Samson knew this was wrong. Because we're told twice that he hides it from his parents. You know, the great power of sin more broadly, and sexual sin in particular, is we try and keep it hidden. We don't really want anyone to know what goes on deep in our hearts. So much guilt and shame and embarrassment in this area, so we keep it all hidden. You know, two mistakes we can make in this area is firstly thinking we can control what's going on in here. And secondly, thinking when I get married, that will sort it. Neither are true. And actually, the power of the secrecy is only broken when we bring things out into the light, when we confess. If you've read C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce, you'll know there's a story in there about a guy who's got a lizard on his shoulder. And the lizard represents the problem of lust or a habitually mismanaged sexual sin. And the man absolutely hates the lizard, but he can't quite bear to live life without it. Well, one day an angel comes and offers to get rid of the lizard for him, but he says, but I need to kill it. Well, the man isn't happy with that. He'd much prefer a gradual process of lizard management. I'm not sure what I'm doing this on my shoulder. Let's put that down. Much rather you just manage the lizard gradually. Thank you very much. Death sounds too drastic. The angel says, no. Death is the only way, but I need your permission first. Well, eventually, reluctantly, the man agrees. Bang. The man and the lizard fall to the floor. He screams out, there's this burning sensation, it's painful. But at the end of that, the man arises free. Totally free of this lizard on his shoulder, this problem of lust, able to now flourish in life. But interestingly, in the story, the lizard rises too. Not just restored, but utterly redeemed and transformed. Lust, that weak, whimpering thing where I just want other people for my own gratification, is transformed into the glory and the splendor of love itself. Nothing is beyond redemption. Now, the power of the secrecy, the hiddenness of sin, is broken only when we bring it out into the light, bring it to the cross, when we confess it openly. But here's the problem. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, does that hurt. Boy, oh boy, does that stink. 20 years ago, there was a psychologist called James Pennebaker who actually wrote a book that would fit quite nicely alongside this series, opening up the healing power of expressing what's going on in here. And he did a major study on confession. He got people to confess mistakes into a tape recorder. And interestingly, every single person experienced the burning sensation that C.S. Lewis described. All of them felt uncomfortable. Many of them cried. Blood pressure rose. They felt negative, very vulnerable, often anxious, way more negative than if they had kept it all hidden and hadn't confessed. But here's the interesting thing. James Pennebaker then observed what happened after the confession. The results were nothing short of astonishing. People felt lighter, freer, able to flourish. There was a sense of joy. Many of them laughed. Blood pressure came down. Often there were seemingly unrelated physical benefits. Life was seen as totally different. They felt freedom, glorious liberty, but they had to go through the burn first. You know, this whole series is about recognizing the thoughts and emotions that go on in here and expressing them in a healthy way. It is important to state that in a number of the talks, not just this area, sometimes getting out those emotions can be a very difficult experience and takes an awful lot of courage. If you faced with the prospect of confession, if that makes you recoil, if it makes you feel uncomfortable, if you think, what would people think of me? I could never do that. You are beginning to experience, even then, the burning that C.S. Lewis described, but you need to know. The other side of that, a mighty stallion can arise. The lizard can be utterly transformed into a different kind of creature. Joy, freedom, hope for the future. But you have to go through the burn first. You know, one of the highlights in the history of this church for me was when a guy stood at the front of church, many of you were there, and he confessed to be struggling in this area. In front of everybody in church, I thought that's the most amazing thing. He talked about how he went to this thing called the Men's Recovery Group, talked about his issues in here and how he and his marriage are now in a totally different place as a result. As we did that interview, many of you were there, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. The atmosphere was extraordinary. And when he stepped off stage, the applause was louder and longer than for any interview I can remember in 13 years of doing this church. No one told you to clap that much. No one asked you to. Why did you do it? It's because we all recognize the power of revealing our inner lizards, our weaknesses in here, and knowing a sense of acceptance, and that there's a possibility of freedom and flourishing the other side. Isn't that what we all long for deep down? That people see me, even the bits that I don't like about myself and am ashamed of, and yet I know there's love and acceptance and a chance to change anyway? Samson never guarded his thought life. He kept everything hidden. He should have been ruthless and he should have confessed. The story continues. Interestingly, while Samson keeps things hidden from his family, he kind of makes a joke of it to the Philistines. We're told there's this start of a wedding feast, and Samson is given 30 companions. These companions would have certainly been Philistines. And he kind of makes this riddle for them. You can see the text coming up on the screen. The final verse is, out of the eater, something to eat, out of the strong, something sweet. He's making this kind of riddle about the honey and the lion, about breaking his vow to God. He's hiding that to his parents. He's kind of boasting about it to the Philistines, and yet he hides his devotion to God to the Philistines. But his parents, his family, his community know all about that. In other words, there is no one who fully knows Samson. One person in one context, somebody else in another. No one knows the full him. Can anyone relate to that? One person on Sundays, someone very different in the week. Maybe, maybe. Things like marriages can look very sparkly on Sundays, but at home we hardly talk. Maybe our leadership is thriving in church on Sundays, but we wouldn't want people knowing the things that we retreat to when we are lonely. That is Samson. That is Samson. No guarding his thought life, no confession, no friends. You know, I often look at people in the Bible who messed things up. Samson, Solomon, Saul, just to name three. I cannot name a single friend that any of them had. It's like all Samson needs is someone to come into his life and not say, whoa, you're a man. Someone who can say, how's it going in this area? How's your thought life? How's your identity? How's your sex life going? He's got no one who fully knows him. What about us? You know, every single person in this room, including me, we are all capable of murdering Keiki. Anyone can do it. 1 Corinthians 10 puts it like this. If you think you're standing firm, be careful lest you fall. I was chatting about this with a guy from Christchurch on the way home from church just a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about a Christian leader in the UK who's recently given in to temptation. And his marriage and ministry are now in all sorts of trouble. And I quoted this verse. I said, you know, to be honest, there but for the grace of God go any of us. If you think you're standing firm, be careful lest you fall. He instinctively replied, oh, Andy, don't worry. You'll be fine in this area. You're ugly enough. You'll have no problems at all. Ah! Thanks for the pastoral care. I appreciate that. But the point is this. Even if you look like me, none of us are immune from this. Too much laughter on the front row, Mr. Stroud. Thank you very much. None of us are immune. That's why we need each other. I was hearing of a guy recently who went on a retreat in the States. And this was a retreat for guys who didn't know each other, all strangers. But they had problems with either sexual addictions or sexual temptation. And not knowing anyone, on the first morning, the guy running the retreat, he started with a confession so deep and so dark. It basically freed up everybody to talk about what was going on inside. This guy said it was utterly transformative, was utterly life-changing. But he came back with this nagging question, which was this. Why was there more authenticity and vulnerability on this retreat with a bunch of strangers than there is in church among friends? I was like, oh my goodness. He's right. How often do I settle for too little depth in my community? Hi, how are you doing? Oh, I'm fine. And we just leave it there. Now, it's my longing that if we crack this, I don't know if we can, but it's what I'm shooting for. If we crack that level of vulnerability, I think London will take notice. Because I think in this loneliest of cities, that's what people are really thirsty for. Not just superficial friendships, but people who know all of me and who love me anyway. When I graduated university many years ago, I actually went to Dave's church in Birmingham at the time, where I was living and working. And my big issue in here, to be honest, was all around image and identity. I did not like me very much. I was incredibly insecure and very, very lonely, but I wanted nobody to know. 2 years from that moment, I can honestly say I was totally free, and life has never been the same since. You know how my journey started? One Sunday, a guy that I'd never met, but who turned out to be the best man at my wedding, he stuck out a hand and said, hi, I'm Steve, what's your name? And we didn't start that week talking about my issues or his. We started by playing GoldenEye on the N64. That's how old I am. And we played it a lot. But slowly we built the kind of friendship where he got to perceive some of my insecurities and failings and me his. And that kind of trust and depth changed my life. Have you got those friends? Not only who can ask you, but who are you helping with the stuff that they're working through in here? This isn't just about me flourishing. It's about us all corporately helping each other. Maybe we can start by building community here, so in 6 and 12 and 18 months, we can have that level of depth in our community. Samson never guarded his thought life. He never confessed, and he had no real friends who truly knew him. The story continues. So Samson is throwing this big feast for his betrothed, and the Hebrew word to describe this feast is probably a big drinking party, possibly, some commentators say, a drinking orgy. And the idea is that people would drink very, very heavily at this feast, including, we can safely presume, Samson. Why? He initiated the feast. It's his idea. And so why is this significant? Well, he has now broken vow number 2 to God. Nothing from the vine. There is only one vow left. Samson is on very thin ice indeed. So he creates this riddle, out of the eater, something to eat, out of the strong, something sweet for the Philistines. His wife, who is a Philistine, she's like, oh, you hate me, you don't love me, why don't you tell me the answer to this riddle? And this big, strong, amazing guy, he ends up giving in to the nagging of a woman, can you believe that? Tells her the answer to the riddle. She in turn tells the Philistines, they in turn, ha ha ha, Samson, we know the answer. And they win the bet. And Samson gets so mad, he ends up going and burning a whole load of crops and killing 30 Philistines. Then the whole wedding thing never happens. The bride ends up being given to like one of the best men. All goes horribly pear-shaped. You know, you kill 30 members of the bridal party, it's just not the same. Kind of lose the sense of the joy of the celebration. So Samson's free of this woman, but he just keeps on going. We're told in Judges 16, one day Samson goes to Gaza where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. Samson is speeding down the slippery slope now. You know, here's what I find interesting. Us, the reader, can see that inside, inwardly, Samson is falling apart. But on the outside, I wonder if anybody knew. Still got his gifting. Still got his look, still got his strength. You know, that's the deal with temptation. It's not like we give into it and God zaps us, kapow, with a lightning bolt. And we're like, oh, no, ouch, won't go there again. You know, we can give in and we can give in and we can give in. And on the outside, at least for a while, we can hold it together. No one need, no. Now, if you don't mind me saying, you are a very beautiful bunch of people. Very impressive indeed. What's happening on the inside? My hunch is that when we give in, when we give in, when we give in, on some level, we all feel it at some point. On goes the story. Samson leaves that woman in Gaza and he goes to a place called the Valley of Sorek. Literally means the Valley of the Vines. It's a forbidden place. He's breaking vow number 2 again. And there he falls in love with Delilah. Verse 15 says this, Delilah says to him, how can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? You haven't told me the secret of your great strength. With such nagging, she prodded him day after day till he was sick to death of it. So he told her everything. No razor has ever been used on my head because I've been a Nazarite dedicated to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me and I'd become as weak as any other man. Now you see the significance of Samson losing his hair. This picture coming up by Rubens depicts the scene. Samson's fallen into a drunken stupor. He's confessed to Delilah, and now the Philistines come and cut his hair. He's never guarded his thought life, kept it all hidden, never confessed, got no community around him, and he's just kept on going, and now his strength is gone. Final vow to God has been broken. And it is at this point in the story that we read, I think, one of the most tragic verses in the whole Bible. Judges chapter 16 and verse 20, it says this, Samson did not know that the Lord had left him. He did not know. Kind of reminds me of a verse in the New Testament, 1 Timothy 4 says this, the Spirit clearly says that in later times some will abandon the faith whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. What does that mean? Well, I don't fully know. But part of what I think is this, that there will be people who have a sense of faith in God and they give in. And they give in, and they give in, and they give in. And it's like they lose all sense of spiritual sensitivity, all sense of what is right and wrong. It's like their hearts grow hard. You know, this part of the story honestly fills me with a sense of holy fear. That's something that starts so simply with seeing and wanting can end up here. If you know the story, the Philistines come for Samson. This guy who doesn't know that the Lord has left him. This guy whose strength is gone. And does anyone know the story? Does anyone know the first part of Samson's body that they go for? Anyone know? It's his eyes. It's his eyes. Remember where the story started? He sees, he wants, he goes down. It's like there's this deeply tragic irony in this story. They gouge out his eyes. And he's bound with what we call bronze shackles. Bronze is often symbolic in the Bible for the judgment of God. And I honestly feel like I'd kind of be discharging my responsibility if I did not warn myself and each of us of the dangers we have in this area. You know, one of the reasons I've actually left out more kind of funny anecdotes and stories from this talk is I've just seen too much brokenness in this area. I've just seen too many people hurt themselves. People who have faith and people who don't, and people who are very dear to me as well. Think of one guy, and I didn't know him, but we met. And it turned out that years ago, he'd given in to a little kind of sexual temptation. And he'd fed it, and it had basically over the years taken over his life, and it had just eaten its way through everything. His family, his home, his finances, his job, his sense of identity. And I didn't know any of this, and I just said, "Hi, it's great to meet you. Tell me your story. How can I help?" And the tears started, and they did not stop. At one point, he cried so heavily that the chair on which he was sitting, it shook, it rocked. I've seen too much of that. And honestly, when I meet people like him, and I've met quite a lot over the years now, and when I read this story, it makes me want to cry out to God, "Oh, please lead us not into temptation and deliver us from evil." But you know, there's a wonderful twist at the end of this story, because that's kind of what Samson does. This guy who's been devoted to God from birth, we're told, the first time in the whole story, we're told at this point he cries out to God. And guess what? God hears him. And there is this wonderful verse that says the hair on his head begins to grow again. Now, it's my conviction that probably nobody has ever lived an entirely sexually pure life. We all have weaknesses. We all have temptations, identity issues, baggage, maybe a sense of guilt or condemnation, regrets in our past, things that we have done wrong. You know, the message of the story of Samson is our story isn't finished yet. There is always hope. And the hair on our heads can, so to speak, grow again. This is metaphorical, not literal, I'm afraid to say. For my bald companions, what's happening here is beyond redemption, I am afraid. But actually, it's just a wonderful picture of the grace of God. Even if your life is as broken as Samson's, and that would take some doing, God is not finished with you yet. You know, even better than that, in the last part of the Samson story, he ends up winning a victory over the Philistines that is not only the greatest victory in the story, it is greater than all the other victories put together. And even better than that, theologians, commentators go wild over what they call the typology of Samson, about how he points to someone much greater, much better. There's a long list of them. I'll just give you two. This guy who is betrayed by Delilah for a few pieces of silver ends up giving his life for the salvation and deliverance of his people. Remind you of anyone? Samson's life, broken as it is a little pointer to the person of Jesus Christ, the only one who's never messed up in this area and through whom we can find forgiveness, true forgiveness, freedom and flourishing. You know, whether you are a person of faith or not, the message of the story of Samson is this, that your story hasn't finished yet. There can be great victories in your future. And when you come to Jesus Christ, actually through your life, broken as it is, your life can point to the person of Jesus. And maybe if this is not an area where you struggle, maybe actually God can use you to point other people to the one through whom freedom, forgiveness, and flourishing can come. Samson never guarded his thought life, kept it all hidden and never confessed, never had community, but all then he cried out to God. It's a very, very powerful story. I wonder if the band could come up. Just to finish with this, that guy that I met, where the chair rocked, it was like years of pain coming out. One of the joys of this job is to help people realize that even in the most broken of moments, they have a future. And it took many years. He experienced the burning that C.S. Lewis described. I mean, at one point, he just couldn't look me in the eye. I just hugged him to let him know, you are safe here. There is a future for you. But watching his life slowly come back together, dealing with what's going on the inside, the insecurity and identity issues, helping him with practical stuff like his finance, his job, seeing him married, seeing him flourish in his relationships and his community. His journey isn't finished yet. None of us are the finished article. But for all of us, the story of Samson is a reminder God isn't done with us yet, and there is a future for us. That is amazing. Would you stand to your feet? We're now going to sing Amazing Grace, I think. Yeah, we're going to sing Amazing Grace. Can I encourage you, whether this story connects with you or not, whether this is an area of temptation you struggle with or not, let's worship him. The one who looked on us in all our brokenness and said, I'm not done with you yet. And I'll come back in a few moments' time and close our time together in prayer. Let's worship.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.